From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, protests at Palantir in New York City and on the West Coast in Palo Alto and Los Angeles for the company's involvement and alleged involvement in the tracking and deporting of immigrants. Six people were arrested at the New York City protest. We'll feature a report from the Palo Alto protest. Also, we'll have a special report on the administration's bid to enforce Trump's executive order denying birthright citizenship to U.S.-born children of parents who are in the country illegally. And also, Kilmar Abrego Garcia will face U.S. trial before he can be deported. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And just this footnote, folks, on an earlier billboard for Flashpoints on this show, we misreported that the arrests happened in Palo Alto, California. The Palantir arrests happened at their headquarters in New York City, not on the West Coast. Just so we make that correction. And we also include an article about the New York City protest as well. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's the People's Radio Network here in the Bay Area, Pacifica KPFA. We're proud to be part of this network that has been speaking truth to power since 1949. And we are going to start by welcoming back Camilo Perez Bustillo. He is the former executive director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Currently, Camilo is part of the leadership of Witness at the Border and a coordinator of the National Lawyer Guild Task Force on the Americas. He's in Mexico City now. Also joining us is our own Miguel Gavilan Molina. Camilo, welcome back to Flashpoints. Can you hear us?
Yes. I'm so honored to join you, Dennis, from Mexico, and to be able to address these issues that affect us on both sides of the border, especially with this imminent decision coming from the Supreme Court. We understand tomorrow about birthright citizenship and all of the other developments, you know, from L.A. to New York that involve our community and the defense of our most basic rights.
Well, let's start. Why don't we start with talking a little bit about what birthright citizenship is and what the administration wants to do in terms of deportations and expanding really just a racist ethnic cleansing of brown people out of these United States. The ones north,
Absolutely. The North United States. Yeah, and, you know, birthright citizenship is an absolutely critical issue for us, you know, as a community. You know, it's linked to the issue you just described in terms of ethnic cleansing and, you know, this kind of great replacement theory that accompanies all of these anti-immigrant policies, not just in the U.S., but around the world, but are kind of the ideological driving force behind mass deportation and mass detention, what we're seeing. The key thing is this, it's this idea of turning the clock back literally before the Civil War, because the origin of the concept of birthright citizenship is in the 14th Amendment, which itself was adopted as part of the process of Reconstruction, where you had the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment recognizing for the first time those who'd been formerly enslaved, African Americans, as full citizens for the first time, and the 15th Amendment recognizing the right to vote of those who'd been formerly enslaved. But the 14th Amendment also, in addition to the concept of birthright citizenship, of course includes the right to due process and the right to equal protection. So that package, the Reconstruction era civil rights amendments, transformed the U.S. Constitution from an instrument that defended and protected slavery during essentially the first almost 100 years of the U.S. as a nation, to the Constitution becoming an instrument for the liberation of the formerly enslaved. Along the way, birthright citizenship within the 14th Amendment incorporated a concept of universal citizenship for those today who we recognize as immigrants. That began with a series of Supreme Court cases in the latter part of the 19th century. The key thing is the case that they are trying to overturn in the Trump administration is a case that had its origins in Chinatown, in San Francisco, the Wong Kim Ark case in 1898 that recognize that a Chinese laborer who was born in Chinatown in San Francisco was entitled to citizenship, even though the immigration officials of that time considered him to be, quote, too Chinese in terms of his language and culture and race, because the 14th Amendment protected him. So birthright citizenship as a principle was extended from the formerly enslaved to immigrants born on U.S. soil. That's the principle that the Trump administration is trying to undo. We don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do. We don't know whether they're actually going to get into the meat, the substance of the issue of birthright citizenship. That's certainly where the Trump administration wants to go. One of the first things Trump did was sign an executive order, in effect seeking to undo, to revoke the 14th Amendment, which you cannot do through an executive order. You would have to amend the Constitution, repeal the 14th Amendment. But he has, we've discovered in a series of Supreme Court cases over the last few months, he has either a 5 or a 6 vote majority, and it could be, they could go as far at least as to undermine the principle of birthright citizenship. We'll see. We'll know tomorrow. But the bottom line is they're going to continue to attack that principle. And the reason is because they want to redefine the U.S. as a white supremacist community that excludes us. And that's what mass deportation and mass detention is really about. And that's what's unfolding as we speak on the streets of Los Angeles and in New York, of course, in response, for example, to the extraordinary victory, the historic victory in the Democratic primary of Mamdani as the candidate who is himself, of course, an immigrant born in Uganda and who has said, has pledged in his election night speech that he will turn New York into a node of resistance to Trump's fascism and to ICE and its mass detention policy.
You did see that the extreme right wing in Congress and in Washington are trying to move to strip him this now the candidate of the Democratic Party for mayor of New York City. They want to strip him of his citizenship before he can take control of New York City.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is basically the same logic of birtherism, which, of course, is what brought Trump into the political arena when he directed it against Obama. It's the same logic. I mean, we've seen these memes of, you know, of course, you know, a burqa, you know, placed over the Statue of Liberty. And we saw, you know, a tweet from Stephen Miller saying, you know, look at New York and Zoran Mandani's victory. That's what happens when immigrants have control. So, you know, the hate campaign has already begun. Islamophobia is in full bloom. Because, of course, Mamdani, who was born in Uganda, came to the U.S. as an immigrant when he was 7 years old, was raised initially in South Africa, is of South Asian origin. He became a naturalized U.S. citizen, you know, precisely through the inclusive application of principles derived from the 14th Amendment. You know, they want to take away from him something that's very much connected ultimately to these broader currents of inclusion that they want to undo.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here. We're speaking with Camilo Perez Bustillo. He is in Mexico City. We are talking about many things having to do. Let me just ask you, we want to bring in Miguel in one moment, but I just want you to clarify. If Trump had his way, as a practical matter, what would that mean for millions of people? Would it have a legal binding?
Yeah. You know, there's two dimensions to this. I mean, one of it is, you know, it's really psychological warfare. That's really what we're talking about. And that, of course, has been, you know, at the core of what has unfolded since January 20th. I mean, it's beginning to get worse because the numbers of people in detention have vastly increased, the number of people being deported, the number of deportation flights, which are what we track, through witness at the border. Things have gotten much worse in the last month. Initially, it was much more a psychological campaign of terror, and that's already done damage that it's going to take years and decades to undo in the hearts and minds of our communities. But now it's also these campaigns conducted, these raids conducted by masked and unidentified agents throughout L.A., in addition to the National Guard troops and to the Marines that have been deployed, and also the L.A. Police and the California Highway Patrol. So really, it's a campaign of terror in every sense, physical and psychological. So all that's been going down. But I think the key thing is this. What they want to do with birthright citizenship, regardless of what the Supreme Court says tomorrow, is through the Trump administration and the MAGA movement's local allies, they want to slowly chip away at the concept at the base. And so what they can do, remember that birth certificates are not normally something that the federal government has any power over. This is something that local, municipal, and county officials are in charge of. You know, it depends on, you know, which hospital you're born at, or which medical center, or which neighborhood, or which community. That's where birth certificates are issued. So the key thing is this. If it's a county or a community or a municipality that's controlled by those aligned with Trump, they have already begun to deny birth certificates to children born on U.S. soil, pursuant to the principle they're seeking to apply, which is that birthright citizenship should no longer be extended to the children of persons who are undocumented. So even if they don't get this from the Supreme Court, and even if they don't succeed in amending the Constitution, which is very unlikely, they're not going to be able to do that unless there's really an extraordinary shift in the votes. The bottom line is they can do it both through psychological terror and through local officials. And we've heard reports of that in red states and red communities. And so we have to be very alert to that. The bottom line is you cannot withhold citizenship to children born on U.S. soil, regardless of the immigration status of their parents, without amending the text of the Constitution. And you can't do that without a constitutional amendment. But they want to do it by exercising terror and their political will.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints again on Pacifica Radio. Camila Perez Bustillo, a regular contributor to this show, talking to us from Mexico City. We're talking about some very serious issues that are going on. Let me bring in Miguel Cabrera Molina. This is certainly a subject at the heart of the matter for you, Cabrera.
Absolutely, Dennis. And thank you, Camilo, for joining us. I just want to get a sense of the reactions from Mexico, and particularly in Mexico City, which is probably one of the most progressive areas in the entire country. What is the feeling on the streets? What have you heard? How are Mexican nationals reacting to their, you know, relatives, cousins, and so forth in the United States that are under attack? Is there any concern? I know the Mexican president, she stated that, you know, if there's a crisis, you know, she welcomes, you know, political refugees. But what is the sense there in Mexico City as to what's happening here right now, you know, with this domestic war escalating against the brown masses?
You know, I've never seen so much disquiet, so much concern in the Mexican people. You know, I have very deep family ties here. My daughter lives here. Much of my extended family lives here. I resided here for over 20 years. You know, I've been long familiar with the community here. And I have to say that both, you know, looking to my colleagues in the human rights community, among those who defend migrant rights here, those who work in the shelters, those who provide humanitarian assistance to migrants, those who receive the migrants who were deported and who return voluntarily, because more and more, sadly, there's this phenomenon that the Trump administration refers to as, quote, self-deportation, which is, of course, a euphemism for people who've been driven back, driven out, right, by the terror that we've been alluding to. And I think what we have to think about is that everything is kind of on pause in Mexico right now. You know, just overnight, it was announced that two more military zones of essentially a kind of state of martial law have been declared at the border, one in the environs of Yuma and the other in the environs of San Antonio. Those of you who know the U.S.-Mexico border region can kind of picture it. That's in addition to two more zones that had already been proclaimed and defined on the map. What that means is that this kind of state of exception that's already governing the streets of L.A., you know, we alluded to in terms of the National Guard and the Marines and, you know, the collusion and the complicity of the L.A. police and the California Highway Patrol, you know, regardless of whatever Karen Bass or Governor Newsom say, in practice, it's the L.A. Police Department and it's the California Highway Patrol that are acting in cahoots, in complicity with ICE on the streets. That's what folks tell us on the street in L.A. Well, you know, in these desert regions along the border, it's even more direct. These are zones of complete military control where any migrant who is detained is subject immediately to abuse directly by military troops. So this, in effect, this is what we've been fearing from the first Trump administration. This is a violation of basic principles of, you know, the Posse Comitatus Act, which is that military authorities should not be involved. This is a constitutional violation in law enforcement. Military authorities should not be involved in law enforcement, and that includes the enforcement of immigration law. Of course, that's what is in effect happening on the streets of LA and has been happening the last few weeks, but it's more indirect. In these zones of military control along the U.S.-Mexico border, it's direct. And so it's again, these are flagrant violations of the Posse Comitatus Act. In effect, this is a way of getting around the so-called Insurrection Act. Of course, ever since the first Trump administration and ever since the summer of 2020, the George Floyd uprising, we've been concerned that the Insurrection Act might be invoked, might be activated. That's still on the horizon. It's still something that's possible. And of course, very recently, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the imposition of federal control, the federalization by Trump of the command of the California National Guard, right? Newsom tried to challenge that. That succeeded initially at the district court level. It was reversed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, and that's not going to change. That's not going to be reversed by the Supreme Court. So the noose is tightening. That's the key thing. And so all of that is being watched from Mexico because, you know, again, the problem is from the Mexican perspective, the noose is also tightening around Mexico. You know, because these zones of exclusive military control, they you know, overlap on areas of Mexican border control and concern. And of course, there's been a lot of rhetoric from MAGA ever since the first Trump presidency, but especially in the last few months and the last couple of weeks, few weeks, about the danger of some kind of U.S. military intervention on Mexican territory, supposedly targeting the cartels. And then think about it. Right. Today, as these zones were announced, and this is, you know, front page news in Mexico, believe me, something that's, you know, causing great concern here on the streets among average people when they see those images of, you know, troops on the Mexican border, right? I mean, that's how it's perceived at the Rio Bravo. On the other hand, there's this noise being made about two Mexican banks supposedly being involved in money laundering. And so that, of course, is linked to the drug war pretext, right? And so, again, there's kind of, you know, the wagons being circled in some way. And there's this sense of Mexico being under siege. Again, we don't know how this is going to play out, but that's the feeling you get here. You know, we had a very powerful community-based event here on Saturday. That's why I initially came here in the last few days, organized by the People's Movement for Peace and Justice, over 100 organizations on both sides of the border. We had, you know, direct links, you know, a binational event challenging, you know, both governments and challenging civil society on both sides of the border to mobilize in defense of migrants and connecting victims of violence on both sides. But the bottom line is the militarization of the border is happening on both sides. And there's terror that's being felt and its ripple effects on both sides. And whatever the Supreme Court says tomorrow about birthright citizenship, again, they might just begin to chip away at it. We don't know how far they'll go, but we'll further add fuel and gasoline to the fire that's already been burning.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilán Molina. We're speaking with Camilo Perez Bustillo. He's the former executive director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Currently, Camilo is part of the leadership of Witness at the Border, and they have been doing extraordinary work keeping track of what happens at the border, the growing violence, and all the things that have to do with this expanding program of organized racism that is supported by the current administration. Things are moving very quickly, Camilla. We're seeing now the, for instance, I wanted you to comment on the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. Now he's back in the U.S., but you know, they got him on about 6 million charges and every kind of program. And if he ever manages to stay home, which he probably won't, because they'll probably come and arrest him again and put him through another set of courts. But what's happening on that front? Why should we care about that case in particular?
You know, the bottom line is he's being singled out and persecuted, both because of the importance of his case individually, because of what he came to symbolize, because of the fact that, you know, he exposed the Trump administration and its errors in those flights that took place on March 15th of this year, three flights with over 270 migrants aboard, mostly from Venezuela, but another 20, 30 or so, including Kilmer, who were aboard, who should never have been sent back to El Salvador because they'd originally fled from there. In his case, he had fled from El Salvador from the same gangs he was sent back to. So he had supposedly obtained protection from being sent back. You know, he was protected from removal. That's the, you know, the legal concept, in effect, a kind of step towards a form of asylum, because he was a victim of persecution by those gangs. And then he was stuck in one of the worst, what is clearly the worst prison, not only in El Salvador, but in Latin America and perhaps the world, where those gangs or supposed members of those gangs precisely are the ones being detained, surrounded by those he was, in fact, seeking to flee from. So it was recognized finally after a couple of rounds before the Supreme Court and other courts that he should never have been deported. He was finally sent back. But of course, they couldn't just let that go. He had embarrassed the administration. He was never permitted to be reunited with his wife and his three children. And so, sadly, the minute he was returned to U.S. territory, he was handed over to federal criminal custody on trumped-up charges. And I say trumped up deliberately, right? Charges of supposedly human smuggling, but essentially they're trying to punish him because he's an embarrassment to the administration. And so they're trying, you know, again, to continue to drag his name through the mud. There's only one charge that's a charge that perhaps he may end up being tried for in Tennessee, of all places. But the bottom line is, we have to understand that this is a punitive prosecution because his very existence and presence on U.S. territory is an embarrassment to this administration. But it's also a reminder that there are over 200 others from those flights still being held at that hellhole of a prison in El Salvador, who are subjected to treatment that is tantamount to torture pursuant to this backroom deal in exchange for $7 million between the tin horn dictator of El Salvador, Bukele, and Trump. And they cut that deal, you know, before the cameras in the Oval Office, and we all saw it, right? So, you know, that's really what's going on with Kilmer Abrego Garcia. He continues to need our solidarity and support, but we also need to remember the other more than 200 who were shipped out on those flights with him back in March and who continue to be held. All of these were victims of a crime that is recognized under international law as a crime against humanity that is known as forced disappearance. And so now it's the U.S. government that's in the business of massive acts of forced disappearance, shipping migrants simply on the basis of their tattoos or suspicion of their supposed membership in drug gangs, supposedly, shipping them to prisons like the one where these migrants are currently being held. But there's also, and this was reported widely yesterday by the New York Times and other mainstream media, there's agreements in the process of being made with 29 other countries around the world to receive migrants under similar circumstances, including a group of migrants who've been held at a military base at the borders of Somalia and South Sudan, an Air Force base in Djibouti. So I mean, this is where we are right now. And Kilmar Abdigo Garcia's case is like the doorway to understand that broader pattern of terror. This is the Trumpian gulag. The new gulag is the Trumpian gulag around the world.
And finally, just a minute or two more. Camilo, in terms of bridging the understanding, this battle for human rights and people's rights, obviously where the whole world has been watching an expanding genocide in Gaza and the West Bank, this is all about human rights. You want to talk about sort of, as somebody has fought your whole life for human rights for all people, how this is impacting on communities here and what that bridge might be between the suffering being carried out in our names with our tax dollars and what's happening here.
You know, I have to say, as I was watching the news from New York, you know, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born and raised there in the Colombian community of Jackson Heights and Queens, which went overwhelmingly for Zora and Mamdani on Tuesday night. I have to say that I was celebrating from here, and my family was out, you know, voting in 103-degree heat for Mamdani, you know, and other Colombian migrant families like mine and Latino and other families were coming out for him. We saw his victory as a victory for us, but also it's a blow for justice for the people of Palestine. You know, the kind of racism and Islamophobia that Mamdani faced throughout his campaign and has faced ever since his victory at the polls was largely because of the position he took on the issue of Gaza and of Palestine. And he did not back down. He took a position of courage and of integrity. And I hope he will continue to do that. But I think we have to understand the vote in New York for mayor and in his favor was also a referendum on Gaza and on Palestine. And that's how it was received in the communities that he has sought to speak for and to represent and reflect. The Arab and Palestinian communities of Brooklyn and the South Asian communities throughout the city that and the Muslim communities that for the first time feel they have a voice and a champion. And that we have a Muslim immigrant standing up and calling out Trump by name and saying that he will defend migrants against mass deportation by ICE explicitly, at the same time, sadly, as Karen Bass and Governor Newsom are backing down, is a very sharp contrast. So he stood up for Gaza and Palestine, and he's standing up for migrants and against ICE and against Trump. And so that tells us a lot, I think. And he's standing up against fascism. He explicitly framed it as rejection of Donald Trump's fascism, and that covers the board, right? From Gaza and Palestine to ICE and migrants.
You know, Senator Gillibrand of New York did a little song and dance, and I went crazy on a New York air. I think she was on with Brian Lehrer in New York City, and she raised as a big problem that he used the word intifada, that clearly makes, you know, he's got to apologize for that and sort of throw himself on his knees. I mean, it really is extraordinary. She was raging. This went on for some time because, I mean, that alone is enough to, you know, make her a suspect. You know, the big corporate politicians in New York did not support him. They did not, you know, they didn't go against him, but they haven't announced their support. Can you imagine Democrats ignoring the leading Democratic candidate for mayor of New York City? And they're going to talk about isolating and refusing to collaborate.
They might, you know, destroy the Democratic Party. It'll be their doing, right? But I think the bottom line, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in November, but I think what he's done is he's shown the way to build a political movement from below, you know, 1.5 million doors knocked, right, with a message of, you know, economic justice and international solidarity and defense of immigrant rights. And, you know, I think that's a message that should ring and resonate for all of us throughout the country and the world. And let me tell you, in Mexico City, that's how his election was received. You know, it was received as stunning news that a socialist Muslim migrant won in the largest city in the world that is the home of global capitalism and of Wall Street, because that's how New York City is understood here, right, and around the world. Again, we don't know what's going to happen in November, but it's certainly, you know, at least a passing, powerful moment of hope that we all needed.
All right. Well, thank you, Camilo, from Mexico City, Camilo Perez Bustillo, for taking the time out and sharing extraordinary amounts of important information that we all learn and grow from and are able to be better citizens, if you will. Thank you. Camilo, be safe. Let's talk soon.
My honor and privilege. Un abrazo, Dennis, y mi hermano Miguel, siempre. Gavilán.
Si se puede.
Si se puede. Gavilán, I didn't realize you were still there. All right. Gavilán, I want you to stay with us, if you will. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk about what's going on with this corporate organization that is playing a role in these sweeps that we're watching now. Stay with us.
Bankers too. Let's get up and learn those rules. When the man and the crazy chief, one says sun and one says sea, AM, the FM, the PM too, turning out that boogaloo. Gets you up and I guess you out, but how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, give me Sonic, so cheap and we're falling. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cent, English pounds and Eskimo pence.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, there was a whole bunch of action happening in Palo Alto this afternoon. Actually, six Well, let me read you a little bit from a press release coming up from down there. Nearly 300 community members rallied and chanted peacefully today across the coast, including seniors, parents, and children. Six community members were arrested during peaceful protests in New York as protesters blockaded the Palantir office in Chelsea. In Palo Alto, protesters dropped a large Palantir Powers Ice banner in front of the Palantir office, shut down the street in front of the office, so they say, and then marched to disrupt DevCon, a nearby Palantir recruitment event. Well, this is something I certainly don't know a great deal about, but it seems like it's important to know about this company and what they're up to. And actually, as we said, people were literally willing to be arrested to protest it. So some folks are concerned. Joining us to talk about it is Katie Na. She is with Planet Over Profits, one of the groups supporting this action. And also Nikki's joining us from Climate Defiance. So Katie and Nikki, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. And you're on with me and Miguel Gavila Molina. And Katie, could you describe what the action was today and what's at the core in terms of Palantir? We don't know much about that group.
Gotcha. I would say that the action today was consisted of hundreds of community members who turned out to Palantir's Palo Alto office. Over 200 folks came out this afternoon around 12 p.m., and it consisted of a big picket in front of the main office, and then eventually led to a march down to the building where Palantir was actually holding a large-scale recruitment event that they call DevCon 3. And so we started out with a picket in order to build up energy, to bring attention to the fact that Palantir continues to have a large presence in Palo Alto, even though they've taken down a lot of their signs, which I think is them showing their hand a little bit and having a sense of public opinion about them at the moment. And then over at the DevCon 3 location, the purpose of us being there was to really bring attention to the young recruits who are being brought in, who might not know much about their prospective employer and might not know a lot about the hands that Palantir has in various different projects, and to bring attention to them and to demonstrate that if you are going to be a company like Palantir, and we can get a little bit into some of the reasons why we were there, but if you're going to be a company like Palantir, if you're going to be a core tech contractor for ICE, if you're going to be a core partner for the Department of Defense to contract out products to the Israeli military, and if you're going to be involved in trying to build out these mass surveillance systems, community is going to hold you accountable, and they are going to raise awareness around all of the work that you're doing directly in our own backyards. And like it was mentioned earlier, we did this in partnerships with groups over in New York City this morning, as well as folks in LA doing something similar last week, or 2 weeks ago now. So we're seeing that there's a lot of momentum and energy around this nationally right now.
And I think, I'm not sure what, we're getting a little bit of interference here. I'm not sure where that's coming from. Dennis Bernstein here. We're talking about a protest that happened in Palo Alto. And I want you to say more specifically your concerns about the work of Palantir. What is your understanding of practically what they've been doing that you can document?
Jump in here as well with any additional context, but we were there to raise awareness and hold Palantir accountable for three core reasons. I would say the first reason is that Palantir is a core tech contractor for ICE. Like I mentioned before, specifically, they work with ICE by creating this platform. It's a software called Falcon Tipline, and it's used by Homeland Security Investigations, HSI, which is a division of ICE. And this software is used to track, identify, and target undocumented immigrants and plan raids that lead to mass deportations. And so it's with this technology that ICE is able to identify, locate, and detain folks en masse by pulling data from sources like DMVs, for example, social media, utility bills, court records, etc. And they generate profiles of folks that they're able to use for arrests, And this doesn't just happen on a small scale, because Palantir also built out what's called Investigative Case Management, ICM, and it's a system that is used to coordinate large-scale deportation operations. So when we see the types of large-scale deportations happening in cities like Los Angeles that target entire communities, entire workplaces, it is enabled by ICM. It's a situation where ICE would not have access to that information. They would not be able to deport entire communities if it weren't for ICM. And so we have serious concerns that they will use these same tools to track any folks that they deem concerning for any reason, especially activists and organizers, et cetera. And so that's one key reason, is for the work that they do in partnership with ICE. The second reason is that Palantir is also a core contractor with the Department of Defense. I believe that as of just this last month, their contracts with the Department of Defense, as well as other federal agencies, now surpassed $1 billion. And a lot of that came in at the very top of this year, once the Trump administration came in. And so these tools that they use, that they build out, particularly for the Department of Defense, are shared with the Israeli occupation forces. And those are tools that provide battlefield AI and surveillance systems that help to really identify, track, target, and target Palestinians. And it's, We see that Palantir's tools are ways for the IOF to optimize their genocide and to specifically go after journalists, medical workers, human rights advocates, et cetera, in Palestine. And the third big reason why we were there is because, as is reported by the New York Times, I believe also in May, and a lot of other intelligence and research that we're seeing from other sources, it's been confirmed that Trump has tapped Palantir to create what is essentially going to be a mass surveillance system via a key product that they're calling Foundry. And so through recent Trump administration contracts since the top of this year, Foundry has been pushed into at least four federal agencies that we know of, including the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services Department, the Department of Defense, et cetera, and Foundry being widely adopted throughout the federal government would be the way that Trump is able to merge information from all sorts of places, right? So if you've ever, for example, signed up for therapy programs, or if you ever have incurred medical debt and like had to default on that, or if you've just had debt on your record, if you've applied for a driver's license, if you try to get married, if you've applied for a domestic partnership, if you are on social media and you're like shouting out certain keywords that are maybe like having you flagged by certain agencies like the DHS, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Foundry is basically allowing Trump to merge that information across different agencies in order to compile this giant database. We know that that would be the largest mass surveillance system in United States history. It's something that we haven't seen implemented in this country before. And that is not a pipe dream. It's not a dystopian fiction. It is something that is actively in the works right now. And so it's for those three key reasons that activists turned out today.
That's the voice of Katie Na. Thank you. She's with Planet Over Profits. We're also joined by Nikki. They are joined with Climate Defiance. They are a part of Climate Defiance. Nikki, tell us what Climate Defiance is and why you're out there today.
Yeah, of course. So Climate Defiance is an organization trying to end fossil fuels across our nation, across our world, and to really point out the accountability of all of these politicians, these billionaires, and so many folks that have their hand in this fascist regime that is enabling the fossil fuel industry. And what all of this connects to is so many other, so much more solidarity activism, really into a lot of what Katie was explaining. And what I would really love to say around how Climate Defiance has really pulled their hand in here is really with the connection to how these billionaires are so connected to the Trump administration and is benefiting so much from funding from investors, from this company. And specifically naming them Peter Thiel, who was the founder of Palantir and is now currently on the board and still is benefiting from the company, is someone who is hand in hand with Trump and is a far right billionaire and is enabling genocide, enabling these ICE raids through, this continued of Palantir, and as well talking about Alex Karp, who's the current CEO, is also someone who is, you can see photos of him and Netanyahu together, and as well is a big Trump supporter. So we can really see where a lot of these billionaires are so hand in hand with the fascist regimes in United States and Israel, and really is where a lot of these products are going in. So with all of that said, we see how connected like a lot of these movements are and where a lot of energy comes together. And for really any organization out there who isn't specifically immigrant rights or is against genocide, we really need to be showing up in this moment to protect our community against authoritarianism, against fascism, and protect folks that are getting kidnapped off the streets, you know, every single day. So I think it's really important that we show up and we build energy in this moment and show our solidarity in this way.
Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina, and we're talking about a company, Palantir, that is alleged to be playing a key role in the expanding suppression of brown people in this country. Gavilan, your response to a corporation like this operating in Palo Alto?
It's frightening because... you know, they're in a way, they're experimenting, you know, with this whole domestic war against the brown masses. And they're, you know, inserting technology. My biggest concern is that, you know, it looks like the country and the technos are going to, you know, basically a society like in China. The Chinese have surveillance on everybody. They've got face recognition, you know, technology and all of that, and just a massive amount of data on people. And it looks like this country is going towards that direction. My fear is something that I heard Elon Musk, you know, I think in the last few months and even last year, make comments to the point that they've got technology that they want to insert in people, you know, to deal with their health, to deal with their, you know, physical conditions and so forth. And that's like being, you know, being celebrated. If that happens, the whole society will come under surveillance completely. And not just, you know, face recognition, but they'll be able to, you know, literally hone onto you and find out your body temperature, what's going on with your brain, what's going on with your feelings and all of that. And then you've got the mix of AI in that, making determinations or making decisions. It's frightening. How do people protect themselves? How do people begin to defend themselves and push back against these technologies and these what I call technical experiments that they're running on society? How can people
Katie, you want to take
back?
A shot on that? Katie?
Sorry, on what specifically?
On how can people protect themselves? How can people, I mean, you're out protesting today, but beyond that, what are you doing? What do you want people to understand? How would you like them to take action, if you would? Maybe you don't want people to take action, but, you know, where does it go? You're out in the street today, a bunch of people arrested, people expressing their concern. You obviously have a wealth of information in terms of your context for being involved, but where does it go from there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I actually think that action is exactly what we need right now. I think that the best way that folks can keep each other safe, and of course, I think anyone would be such a strong proponent of finding ways to protect your privacy, watch your digital footprint, et cetera. But those are all reactionary steps, right? Those are all reactions that you have to this impending surveillance state. And the proactive way to actually respond, the most important way to stop these horrors before they actually get here, instead of just meeting them once they're here, is through mass action. And so I would say that, number one, it is really important. It is more important than ever that folks are turning out into the streets en masse, that we're seeing mass civil disobedience, that we are seeing mass outrage that folks can't ignore, that is not just living online, but is proof, right? Is proof that takes the form of hundreds, thousands of people in the street showing their dissent, showing that they will not that they don't want to comply with Palantir's agenda, that they don't want to comply with Peter Thiel's agenda. And so folks who organize, some of the organizers from today's action, even though, again, folks turned out from all across the Bay Area, and these are community members who were really driven to respond largely because of these recent ICE raids and the horrors in Palestine. But the main organizers of today's action are with a summer campaign that's called Stop Billionaire Summer. It's an 8-week long arc of direct action, community organizing, and political education that is going to be targeting the billionaires profiting from authoritarianism, climate collapse, the erosion of our democracy, protesting against ICE, the Trump administration, billionaires like Peter Thiel, et cetera. And so this is a Bay Area-specific campaign, but I would say that there are going to absolutely be movements like this and campaigns like this happening all across the country this summer, and the folks should absolutely be joining up with those. And the biggest reason why, right, when you ask that question of, okay, so you have all this information, you're out in the streets, then what? The reason is that our goal, the ultimate end goal here and the process that we get there with is sustained action. I would say that we know that sustained action, that getting folks on the street to physically mobilize, show their dissent with proof of their bodies, be joining up with other community members and really be naming names and like pulling shady organizations and actors out from the shadows, connecting the dots, et cetera. We know that that works. Right. And we know that because the Tesla takedown movement actually just happened. I think the Tesla takedown movement is such a good example of how sustained action leads to concrete wins. It leads to Elon Musk being ousted from the White House. It leads to permanent brand damage to Tesla, and folks no longer want to be associated with driving Teslas or owning Teslas. And we see that that reputational damage, that loss of trust, that loss of credibility really cost Elon Musk some serious political clout that he otherwise would still be using in the White House to really cut and slash key federal services. And so we see the Tesla takedown was a ginormous win, and it was a win because there's so much energy out there right now. So many people are so angry with the fact that billionaires have hijacked democracy in a lot of ways because they have a lot of money, because they've amassed a lot of money. They're able to fund certain politicians who will advance their agenda, like Donald Trump, and they can essentially buy themselves the right to do whatever they want with their democracy. And so we see that we have to hold them accountable. We can't let them get away with that. And the best way to do that is
we've got 15 seconds. If people are interested in getting more information and following up, what can they do?
What they can do is they can text a short code, actually. They can text STOP BS to 51905. So text STOP BS, no spaces, to 51905.
All right. We thank you both for joining us. Thanks, Miguel Gavilán Molina. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are out of time.